2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's mighty men and the whole Israelite army, but David remained in Jerusalem. Why was Israel's king not out leading the nation in battle? Verse 2, one evening, David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent somebody to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. The Hebrew there literally says to take her. He sent messengers to take her. She came to him and he slept with her. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." Verse 6, so David sent this word to Joab, his army commander, "Send me Uriah the Hittite," that was her husband. And Joab sent Uriah to David. David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "You know, I know you're tired. Go down to your house and wash your feet." David is super friendly, very casual. Uriah probably felt flattered that the king would want to talk directly with him. After some small talk, David says to Uriah, "Listen, man, I know it's been a long journey. I know you've been away from your wife for quite a while, so why don't you go home and wash your feet?" That's a Hebrew euphemism, by the way, for go home and kick back and sleep with your wife. That way, David figures, everybody, including Uriah, will assume that the baby is Uriah's. So Uriah left the palace and a gift from the king was sent to his home after him. Undoubtedly, it's a reference to wine and raisin cakes, which we learned a couple of weeks ago. We're like Hebrew aphrodisiacs, verse 9. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all of his master's servants and did not even go down to his house. David was told later, Uriah didn't even go home last night. So he asked Uriah, "Haven't you come home from a military campaign? Haven't you been out on the road for quite a while? Why didn't you go home, sailor?" Verse 11, Uriah said to David, "Well, the ark of Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and the king's men are camped in the open country. How could I possibly go to my house and eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, O king, I will not do such a thing." Uriah turns out to be quite noble and quite loyal. Verse 12, then David said to him, "Well, then stay here one more day, and tomorrow I'll send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk, because drunk men tend to lose their nobility, of course. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. Again, he did not go home, whether that was an intentional choice on his part or if he was just so drunk that he collapsed before getting home. Either way, he never made it home. So verse 14, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. It was already sealed, so Uriah would not have read it. David probably figured that if he tried to a third time to get Uriah to go into Bathsheba, that people might get suspicious. So in the letter that he handed to Uriah, he says to Joab, "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is the fiercest. Then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." In other words, send out Uriah into the hottest part of the battle, and then have the rest of the army pull back from his company and let my enemy armies take care of my problem. Uriah literally carries in his hand, unwittingly, his own death sentence. And so Joab did what the king commanded. Verse 18, then Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'No, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" Let me translate that for you. Joab knew that what he commanded would have been considered a boneheaded military mistake that no experienced general would ever make. And he's afraid that when David hears about this, David is gonna forget that David is the one who ordered it, and he's gonna blame Joab for being careless. So Joab says, "When David hears what happened, just emphasize Uriah, wink, wink, Uriah died too, and then he'll remember." And so the messenger, verse 22, told David everything Joab had sent him to say. He said, "And some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. David told the messenger, say this back to Joab. Joab, don't let this upset you. You know, the sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab. By the way, this is the kind of good old boy network that far too many sex abuse victims have encountered, where powerful men watch out for each other's backs. Verse 26, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him that son. And everybody just assumed that she just got pregnant on their honeymoon. And David, by the way, even got some good PR out of it, because now he's taking care of the family of a fallen soldier, and they all live happily ever after, right? 2 Samuel 11 ends with these chilling words, but the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. I want everybody in here who's ever been any kind of victim or any kind of survivor of sex abuse, I need you to see that last phrase, because what it means is that God sees. He saw, and it displeased him, and he will bring justice. I want you to let this sink in, church. This is David, the man after God's own heart, the hoped for and long anticipated king of Israel, David, the giant slayer, David, the sweet shepherd of God's people and author of so many beautiful psalms, David, who had refused so many times to take matters into his own hands, David, to whom God made all those incredible promises in 2 Samuel 7, David, who spoke so beautifully about integrity and worship, as Pastor Brian showed us last weekend. This David, same guy, has taken one of his younger captain's wives and slept with her, and then had that loyal colleague and his company of soldiers murdered to cover it all up. By the way, in 2 Samuel 23, later in this book, we're gonna find out that Uriah had been one of David's mighty men. Mighty men was an elite group of 37 fighters that were like David's Praetorian Guard, his Navy SEAL Team 6, brothers in arms who had been with David from the beginning. Uriah had joined up with David when David was an outcast in the wilderness, running for his life. Uriah had believed in David and stood by David when nobody else would. He had fought with David and bled with David. And now David not only steals his wife, he has him murdered. And not just him, by the way. When Joab ordered the army to pull back, he left the whole squadron exposed, which means that a bunch of soldiers died, all as a cover-up for David's pleasure. Now, there are some very important things in here that we can learn about sexual sin and abuses of power. And I'm gonna point those out. But more importantly, this passage is going to answer an even deeper question for us. And that question is, why does every human leader end up disappointing us? Fathers and mothers, pastors and coaches, mentors, bosses, best friends, they all disappoint. Maybe not this badly, but they all do to some degree. Why is that? I'm gonna show you today what to do with that when it happens to you. And then ironically, I'm gonna show you how understanding that can help you avoid doing to somebody else what David does to Uriah and Bathsheba. Two things we're gonna see today. Number one, we're gonna see the nature of David's sin. Number two, we're gonna see our longing for a righteous king and how God fulfills that. Number one, the nature of David's sin. How did David get into this situation? How did he get into this situation? Let me make several observations, okay? The first observation is that David was disengaged from the battle. Did you see that in verse one? Verse one says, in the times when kings go off to war, David stayed in Jerusalem. For maybe the first time in his adult life, David is not leading God's people into battle. He sends out a proxy and he stays at home. David, the mighty warrior, the one who rushed out into battle against Goliath all by himself, when everybody else in the army stood like cowards on the sideline, now he is not even with the armies. David, the warrior, has become David, the relaxer. And that sets him up for this encounter. You see, friend, when you are disengaged from the battle that God has for you, that is when you are most susceptible to the temptations of the flesh. Now listen, everything I'm gonna say today applies to both genders. But let me talk for a moment specifically to you men. Man, it is when you have disengaged from your role as spiritual leader in your family or your community or whatever sphere God has given you to lead in. It is when you've disengaged from that leadership role that the allure and the excitement of sex promises a fulfillment, a distraction, an adventure that you desperately crave. Man, listen, you were created to lead. I don't care if you're type A, I don't care if you're outgoing or not. You were created to lead. You were created to fight. You were created to serve. You were created to protect. And when you are not doing that, that's when those God-given energies look for a different outlet. And quite often that outlet is the intoxication of illicit sex. I can tell you from personal experience that the attractions of illicit sex lose a lot of their power. Not all of their power, but a lot of it. When you are actively engaged as the spiritual leader in your family or in whatever forum God has given you to lead in. You are to be actively engaged in the battle. And when you are, you won't be as susceptible to these cravings. Don't believe me? Try pulling down your pants in a rugby match. You don't have time to think about that in a rugby match. You got people coming at you from every direction. You got too much to focus on to think about that. For many of you men, see, your problem is not a lustful body. Your problem is a bored soul, an empty soul. It's not that you have uncontrollable lust. It's that you've not yet stepped into the leadership calling that God has for you. For many of you, your sexual sin, it doesn't start as a sin of commission. It starts as a sin of omission. It's because of what you have omitted from your life in being a spiritual leader that you then become susceptible to the commission of the sexual sins of whatever variety. Second thing for you to notice is that David put himself into a place where he could be tempted. He put himself in a place where he could be tempted. He's out walking on the roof. At night, this is like the Old Testament version of browsing the internet alone late at night. He points, he clicks, and he clicks again. And then he dwells. And then the feelings start to overpower him. Sexual sins usually don't overtake you all at once. The temptation grows gradually, and you become complicit with the temptation. Maybe it's going for drinks with that person after work. Or maybe it's meeting them in the bar late at night when you're on a business trip together. Maybe it's engaging in extensive private text conversations. Maybe it's just ensuring that you show up at the same place at the same time in your neighborhood so that you happen to run into them. In those moments, you can almost always rationalize whatever it is you're doing. Oh, we're just hanging out. Oh, we're just getting drinks. Oh, we just really understand each other. There's some things we've really connected on. We can really help each other out. But you have put yourself in a place to be tempted and you know it. Long before you commit the sin, you know that it's coming. You just won't be honest with yourself about what is happening because you enjoy the temptation. A lot of times we use passive tense verbs to explain our active sinful choices. I was tempted. I got carried away. I got caught in a bad place at the wrong time. But here's the thing. You put yourself in those positions. You wanted to be tempted. So don't use passive tense verbs to excuse your active tense choices. It's not usually I was tempted, but I chose to be tempted and I liked it. Write this down. It's easier to avoid temptation than it is to resist it. It is easier to avoid temptation than it is to resist it. Y'all listen, as a child of the 80s, I learned many of my most important life lessons from Mr. Miyagi on Karate Kid. And one that always stuck with me was from Karate Kid 2, where Mr. Miyagi said, the best way to avoid a punch, Danielson, best way to avoid a punch is to stay out of places where you're likely to get into a fight. Before you work on all the moves of how to avoid the punch, just don't go in a place you're gonna get in a fight. It is easier to avoid temptation than it is to resist it. Or like Martin Luther, the 16th century reformer used to say, if your head is made out of butter, stay away from the fire. Right? If your head is made out of butter, don't go near the fire. Don't take a chance of having your head melted off. Your head's too important for you to take chances with. See, and that means you're gonna have to make decisions that others are not gonna understand. They might even ridicule them, but for you, the stakes are just too high. Years ago, I read this thing by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and if you don't remember, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor who stood up against the Nazi regime. He even participated in this sabotage attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler and ultimately was hung for it. Bonhoeffer said something in his book, Temptation, that I thought perfectly described my own path. Listen to this. In our members, there's a slumbering inclination toward desire that is awakened with sudden ferocity. with irresistible power, all at once, desire seizes mastery of the flesh. The flesh burns and is in flames. In this moment, God becomes quite unreal to us. Desire envelops us in darkness and makes us utterly forget God. Therefore, the Bible teaches us that in times of temptation to our flesh, there is one command. Quote Scripture. Is that what it says? No, there's one command. What's the Bible say? Flee. Flee youthful lust. Flee worldly temptation. Run! No human being, he says, no human being has within them the strength to resist such overpowering emotions. Again, can I remind you this from a man who stared down the Nazi regime and was ultimately executed for it? This is not a guy who lacks willpower. This is not a guy who lacks stamina. It's not a guy who lacks courage. But even he says, no human being has within them the strength to resist such overpowering emotions. So I will say it to you again. It is easier for you to avoid temptation than it is for you to resist it. Many today mock the idea of a married man or married woman who refuses to be alone with somebody of the opposite sex. And listen, y'all, I get it. I get it. We live in a world where men and women have to do business together and they should be able to relate to each other like equals and colleagues and not just potential sex objects. So I understand. But before you tear down a wall, you should at least ask why it's there. I believe that we, men and women, can treat each other with respect and dignity and have legitimate friendships and still recognize that it is not wise to put ourselves in situations where we can be tempted. Stay off the balcony. For some of you, that means getting accountability around your internet, Covenant Eye software, or something like that would work. For others of you, that means rethinking who you text with or how often you text or what you text about or being honest with yourself about how much you're enjoying certain interactions. I will tell you, my wife has all my passwords and open access to every form of communication in my life. We have two apps that show exactly where each other is at all times. That is not because we don't trust each other. We do. I just don't want anything to grow in my life in secret. I don't want to play Russian roulette with my family or the lives of my kids or the lives of others or my own soul. David put himself in a place to be tempted. The third thing to notice is that David objectified this woman. He didn't think of her as a person. He thought of her as an object for his pleasure. The author points this out to us in a very subtle way. Did you notice it? Verse 3. When David sent somebody to find out about who this woman was, the response came back, oh, this is Bathsheba, she's got a name, the daughter of Eliam, that's her dad, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite, that's her husband. Why does the author record it that way? It's because he is reminding us that Bathsheba was not just a beautiful woman, she was somebody's daughter. She was somebody's wife. She was, might have been somebody's mother. This is a person who loves and was loved for things far beyond the beauty of her body. But see, David didn't think about any of that, does he? She's just an object to satisfy his lusts. Many of our worst sins begin with dehumanizing somebody. We hear about Nazi crimes or even about the slave trade in our own country, and we think, how could actual civilized, religious, moral people do things like that? I took a tour of the Rosa Parks Museum this week when I was in Montgomery, Alabama, and one of the exhibits explained how that could happen in our country. Many white slave owners, this exhibit explained, some of whom otherwise might have been decent moral people, objectified African Americans, and that kept them from thinking about what horrible things they were inflicting on an actual person. See, that happens with sexual sin too. You forget that you're dealing with somebody's life, usually multiple people's lives. This person is somebody's daughter, somebody's mother, somebody's wife or future wife. That man that you're messing around with is some little girl's daddy. One of the books that we use here in our G4 groups at the summit, those are groups that help people who struggle to overcome temptation, gives this really practical counsel to men. Listen to this. It says, men, when you're at the mall, and you notice an attractive woman, look at her face and notice if she looks tired. If she's carrying packages, consider who she might be carrying them for. And think, I bet she's a great mom. Make her a person and give her a life and ask yourself, I wonder if she knows Jesus. Then pray for her. You see, giving her a spirit will often dispel the temptation. You get what I'm saying there? Well, I tell you, one of the things that has always kept me away from pornography is realizing that the person on the other side of that camera is a real person. She was once a little girl with all kinds of dreams that did not include being looked at like this. She's probably sex trafficked. Statistically, we know that's probably true. Somewhere attached to that girl is a brokenhearted father and a brokenhearted mother. Friend, don't miss this. This sin began with a version of pornography. David is gazing at her, and that led to objectification of her, which led to the destruction of her. You see, psychologists tell us that pornography trains your heart and mind to objectify the opposite sex. It literally rewires your brain so that you see someone from the opposite sex as an object. One author says, and I quote, he says, the individual who views image after image causes his or her brain to remold in such a way that eventually establishes that sexual pattern as normal. Pornography damages your ability to even bond in a committed marriage one day. Listen, men especially, if you got pornography in your life and you are not willing to deal with it, for the sake of your relationship with your wife or your future wife or pretty much all women, you need to get rid of it today. And if you are dating somebody seriously or you're engaged and you are not willing to address this radically, dramatically, and immediately, then you at least owe it to her to tell her you are bringing this into your relationship. She deserves to know. Give her the option to opt out now before it comes out later and you devastate her heart. Now, I say men on this, but we know pornography is increasingly a problem for both sexes. I want to invite you to come and start a conversation, to talk to your campus pastor or your women's director. They can tell you where to start. They can perhaps even point you to one of our G4 groups if that's going to be a good fit. David was disengaged from the battle. He put himself in a place to be tempted. He objectified her. Next, David abused his power. David was able to make all this happen because David was the king. Again, verse 4 says he took her. Now, some have raised the question of whether that means David raped her and that he gave her no choice in the matter. That is a valid question. How consensual was Bathsheba in all of this? It doesn't say. On the one hand, there are Hebrew words for rape, and they are not used in this passage, nor is this story presented like the rape that takes place in chapter 13, where Amnon, David's son, forces himself on Tamar, his half-sister. But it is true, David was the king, and he had the power. And if the king demanded something, she probably felt powerless to resist him. I can only imagine what she was feeling when those messengers of David suddenly showed up at her door. In fact, the parable that Nathan, the prophet Nathan, uses in the next chapter to confront David about this sin presents David as a greedy thief who steals a helpless lamb from his neighbor's flock. What we can say for certain is that David's sin here involves an egregious abuse of power, because regardless of whether or not she was complicit at all, David used his position to take what did not belong to him from those who were essentially powerless to resist him. Now, y'all, I don't have to tell you that we live in a society where we constantly hear stories of people who leverage their positions of power to exploit others. God's people were supposed to be different. We were supposed to use our power to protect and to serve, never to exploit and abuse. By the way, some of you have been on the other side of this. Somebody objectified you and didn't take into account what their sin was going to do to you or your family. Some woman or some man selfishly used your spouse or your child with no thought of the destructive tsunami waves it would send to your family. Or maybe it was you yourself that got used. Maybe it even happened against your will. Somebody exploited their power over you to abuse you. This chapter shows you there is a God who sees. And the thing displeased him, and he will execute justice on your behalf. I want you to know that we have women's directors and pastoral teams that want to walk with you in your hurt through that, if that applies to you. One more thing to notice here before I go on to that second question. I want you to notice that sexual sin destroys lives, absolutely destroys lives. David's sin destroyed Uriah and Bathsheba's home. We're never told about the personal trauma that it caused to Bathsheba. It says that when Uriah died, she mourned, and I wonder how much is hidden in that one word. But we do know for sure that it led to the murder of several innocent men and the death of a child. Chapter 11 marks a turning point in David's own life, you see. From this point on, David's family, his life, and his kingdom start to unravel. In the next chapter, the prophet Nathan is going to prophesy that because of this, the sword will never depart from David's house. In the chapter after that one, 2 Samuel 13, one of David's sons is going to rape his half-sister, and then he's going to be murdered by her older brother. And then a couple of chapters after that, Absalom, who is David's oldest son, is going to lead a rebellion against him, and he's going to take half the kingdom, and he's going to sleep with a lot of his dad's wives, and then is himself murdered. This is an important lesson even for those whose sexual sin may not be in the same category as David's. Our sin affects everybody around us. I read a book one time where a guy listed out all the things that would happen if he committed adultery. And it made me make my own list. It was so impacting to me. I just pulled out a notebook and I jotted my own list. I wrote down, if I had an affair, I would cause untold hurt to Veronica, my wife, and I would have to endure the loss of her respect and trust and might forever forfeit my relationship to her. I would cause deep hurt and confusion in Karis, Allie, Raya, and Adden, who may never understand why I traded a close relationship with them for a cheap thrill. Yeah, I would likely stay involved in their lives, but my relationship with them would never quite be the same. I would bring shame on my mother and father. I would bring endless judgment on the woman I committed adultery with. Her life would be forever labeled by this encounter. If she had kids, I would be the biggest stumbling block for them ever learning to trust in Jesus. I would confuse and discourage many in their walk of faith. I would cause shame to you, my church family. I would give easy fodder to all those who are searching for reasons to mock Christianity and say that it is phony and untrue. I would follow in the footsteps of men I know whose immorality forfeited their ministries and stained the name of their churches, men that you have heard of. Most importantly, I would grieve my Lord and Savior, and one day I would have to look him in the face and explain to him why, after all that he had given to me, after all the blessing and all the beauty that he had put into my life, why I had to have something else. Listen, I'm not trying to drive some of you who have committed sexual sin into despair. But I want to be clear. Okay, listen. There is forgiveness for sexual sin. We're going to see this next week. David is not only going to be forgiven, God is going to create beauty even from these tragic ashes. Jesus is still going to choose to go by the name Son of David. David's Psalms are not taken out of the Bible. We still use them as the basis for our worship songs today. Most of Jesus's quotations in the New Testament come from the Psalms that David wrote. In other words, despite this heinous sin, God did not cancel David. God still had plans to bless David and to use him for good after this sin. That's just the kind of God we serve, y'all. And I know so many stories, beautiful stories right here in our own church, beautiful stories of grace and redemption after sexual sin. But see, I also need you to see that even with forgiveness, this kind of sin is devastating. Both for the person you sin with or against and all of his or her relationships. It's like we often say here at the Summit Church, you can always get forgiveness from sin, but you can't unsin. Meaning your sin, even after forgiveness, leaves waves of destruction that can take a lifetime or even several generations to deal with. So I'm just saying, if you're on the brink of sin, flee. If you're in the middle of sexual sin, confess it now. One of David's problems is that each cover-up attempt makes it harder and more impossible to confess. It's like he became trapped in this web of lies he had spun. Confession is always painful and humiliating, always. But the longer you wait, the more trapped you feel, and the more devastating the consequences become. Stop trying to lie your way out of this. Confess right now and put your hope in Christ right now, and let him start the healing process today. Don't multiply sin with more sin. And listen, I know this has been difficult, especially for some of you, but let's turn now to the most important part of this message, okay? Number two, our longing for a righteous king. Like I said, I know this has been hard for us to just sit through. But put yourself for a moment, would you? Put yourself in the shoes of Israel. David was their long anticipated and hoped for king. And he'd started out so well, hadn't he? Defeating Goliath, those bold demonstrations of selflessness and faith and those beautiful psalms he wrote about God. And now at the end of this chapter, Israel asks through broken hearts and through tears, if even King David, the man after God's own heart, if even he failed us, what hope is there? And when you ask that question, you are finally reading the Bible the right way. See, this story makes clear what we've seen hinted at in David's life all along. You need a king far greater than David. You need a king more faithful, a king who will always act with integrity and will not abuse or exploit you. Listen, every earthly thing you put your hope in is going to disappoint. Every human institution, every leader, every person. Maybe the one bright spot right now in our dismal political dumpster fire that is CNN and Fox News is that some of us are finally realizing that salvation is not going to be found on the other side of the political aisle. It's not on our side or that side. The problem is not the Republicans. The problem is not the Democrats. And I'm not saying that there are no good leaders out there or that they are all equally bad. I'm just saying that maybe some of us are finally learning that our salvation doesn't come from a donkey or an elephant. It comes from a lamb. We long for a different king, don't we? A king greater than David. And this is the beautiful part of this story. That other king that we long for is strangely prefigured in this story, not by David, but by Uriah. Think about Uriah for a minute. Uriah was innocent and selfless. Uriah was loyal to David to the very end. Uriah could not even bring himself to enjoy a night of legitimate pleasure when his countrymen were in harm's way. And when Uriah was placed on the front lines of the fiercest part of the battle and told to charge into the face of death, Uriah did so without hesitating or complaining. In the end, Uriah died, but not because of his sin. He died because of David's. Now, who does that all remind you of? Jesus was the true mighty man, loyal to the end, who refused to partake of pleasure when we were in harm's way, and then he rushed into battle on our behalf, even when it was certain that he would die. In the end, Jesus died like Uriah, not for his sins, but for ours. Uriah beautifully gives us a picture of the steadfast love of God that God had promised to David just a few chapters before this. A love that would never depart from him. Yes, David sinned grievously, and yes, there would be devastating consequences from it, but the steadfast love of God would never depart from the house of David. And God would ultimately die for David's sin, just like Uriah did. And yet, there is one crucial difference between Uriah and Jesus. Uriah went to his death unaware of how David had betrayed him. Jesus approached death fully aware of our betrayal, and yet he went to the cross eagerly anyway. Jesus died willingly to pay for all the sins you had committed against him and all the ways you had betrayed him. Jesus is the righteous king that you were looking for. Which leads me to the last thing that ties all of this together. The way we overcome sin is by being captivated by the beauty of the true king. I said at the beginning, but all of us to different degrees find ourselves in positions where we got the power to exploit somebody else. Maybe not like this, maybe not even sexually, but in some way, we're in a position of power. And many of us, even those of us who have experienced injustice at the hands of others, will turn around and do that to somebody else when we're given the chance. It's like the great irony of human history. Hurt people hurt people. Y'all think about it. Early in David's life, he'd been the victim. Now he's the victimizer. How can we escape this incredible propensity toward exploitation? The answer, by seeing Jesus as the king who laid down his power and privilege for us. You see, David felt driven to possess Bathsheba because his soul was bored and hungry. It's when your soul and your heart is empty that you crave sinful pleasures and you become willing to do whatever it takes to get them. The only way to escape those temptations is to fill up your soul with the love of the king. You see, a lot of people are going about trying to conquer their lust the wrong way. They try to strengthen their own self-control, or they try to eliminate the temptations altogether. I'm just gonna tell you, that ain't ever gonna work. The Puritan Thomas Chalmers explained that you can only bring certain desires in your heart under control by replacing them with a stronger desire. Think of an athlete who brings incredible discipline to his or her body because of their desire to win. It's not even that they're spiritual or they're Christians, but they can push their body to the limits. They can say no to all kinds of pleasures because they've got a stronger desire inside them to win. Those lesser desires, the desires to eat bad for you foods or sleep late or watch TV all the time, those are all brought under discipline by a stronger desire. Chalmers said, but your passion for God's got to become like that, where you desire God and his will so much that it brings all lesser desires under control. Thomas Chalmers called this the expulsive power of a new affection. Our problem, he said, is not that our cravings for sex are too strong. He said, no, your problem is that your passion for God is so weak. What you need is not diminished attractions to sin. What you need are stronger affections for God. How do you develop those, you ask? How do you develop those? How do you develop those stronger passions for God? Is it by memorizing the right verses? Is that it? Singing songs, being in church all the time? Is it through your resolution, your will? Is it praying the right prayers and a magic prayer? Is it getting, touched, on the head at the front of the church? Is that how? No. None of those things. You cannot just tell yourself, develop a consuming passion for God. Those passions come only from beholding Christ, Christ, the truer and better David, Christ, the true King who served not himself but you, Christ who sacrificed himself for you instead of sacrificing you for him. See, and when you see through the eyes of the Spirit that he is the King you've always yearned for, then his beauty captivates your heart to the point that you gain the power to say no to sin. That's why the Apostle John says, behold, look. Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us. Look at it, then look at it again, and then look at it till you can't look away, that you ought to be called the children of God. That's the kind of love God gave for you, and so we are. And we know that when he appears, we're gonna be like him because we will see him as he is. And see, everybody who thus hopes in him, everybody who has this hope purifies himself just like he's pure. Question, are you paying attention? What motivates us to purify ourselves? What motivates you to purify yourself? What's John say? A desire to see him and be like him. Friend, do you get it? That's the gospel invitation. Come behold. Come behold. The gospel is not go and become. The gospel is come and behold. And you gotta have spiritual eyes to see this. So you gotta ask God, you gotta beg God to give him those eyes to you. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and then the things of earth grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. But that takes spiritual eyes to see. I mentioned at the beginning the revivals around our country. You know, revival, there's a lot of like, what is it? Sounds weird. It's just people being given spiritual eyes to see the beauty of Christ. That's literally all that it is. That's what we need, church, and that's where this passage leaves us. So see, I want us to ask God for that today. We're gonna turn our campuses, all of them, into houses, into tabernacles of prayer, a house of prayer for all nations. And here's what I want you asking God. I want you to ask him to open your eyes to this beauty. I want you to ask him to open the eyes of your family to this beauty. Before we do that, let me make some very specific applications, okay? I want everybody, if you would, to stand to your feet all over at all of our campuses. I'm gonna ask right now that our campus teams come and they're gonna begin to take their places, pastors and prayer team leaders, women's directors at all campuses. They're gonna come right down here. I want you to listen very closely. I'm gonna talk very specifically to a handful of you in different categories. There are some of you listening to me right now who have committed sexual sin. I want you to know that there is forgiveness, full and free, but you have to confess it. And I'm gonna invite you to come to these altars and confess it before God. Stop trying to lie your way out of it. You're just making it infinitely worse. When you confess, yes, there are probably gonna be things that you gotta do. My friend, I got good news. God has not canceled you. He never will. He still has plans to use you for good, but those plans start with confession. Let me talk to another group, okay? Here's a second group. We got a lot of middle school and high school and college students and unmarried. We can sing a group of singles, young professionals. I want to challenge you to commit today to submit your sex life to God and say, God, I'm gonna do it your way with your help. I want you to grab a friend. I want you to come down and pledge that to God and ask him for his help. Of course, you can sit right there in your seat and do it. I understand that. I'm just telling you, it'll be better if you come and pray around the front. There's something symbolic and significant about doing that in front of the altar. Maybe you've been victimized. Maybe like Uriah and Bathsheba, somebody used you and discarded you. I want you to know that there is healing in Jesus for you. The cross not only offers forgiveness for sinners, the cross also promises healing for sufferers too. God saw it and it displeased him, and he will bring justice. And in the meantime, you can find healing in the love of the King who voluntarily laid down his life for you. Maybe you need to come forward and pray through that and start that healing process. Maybe talk to somebody if that would be helpful. If not, you can just pray open. We're just gonna open the altar at all of our campuses. Our campus pastors, prayer teams are up here to talk and pray with you if helpful. Maybe you just wanna come and pray on your own. People have been doing that in every service. The most incredible things have been happening. You say, well, yeah, JD, can I do all this from my seat? Yes, you can. You can. But there is something significant and symbolic about coming up here and taking this before the Lord. It will change you. Maybe you need to pray for somebody else. Maybe it's not you. Maybe it's a child. Maybe it's your college-age son or daughter. Maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's a roommate. Parents, maybe you need to come and pray for your kids to make these kind of decisions to honor God with their sexuality. That's what Veronica and I will be doing. I just want to invite you to come up here and pray. Maybe you need to receive Christ. And you know you've sinned, maybe not with this one specifically, but you know you've sinned and you're just not sure though you've ever received Jesus' forgiveness and salvation. I want you just to come down and take the hand of one of the people standing down front here and just tell them that. That's why all these people are up here. It's why these altars are open. Maybe you just want to ask God to open your eyes and the eyes of our church to better see the glory of Christ so that you're not so enticed by sin. A lot of us ought to be doing that. So let's just go before the Lord, okay? Our worship teams are coming at every campus. I want you to use this time to come before God. Dad, some of you ought to grab your wife, grab your family, and you ought to step out and come and just be a family that says, we're gonna ask God for help in this area, okay? As our worship teams come right now, don't hesitate. Just do it right now. If you wanna stay in your seat and turn around and get on your knees, you can do that too. But let's turn this place into a tabernacle of prayer and let's ask God for his help. You come as the Spirit prompts you. You come, let's pray together.